Domi banked the craft gently to head them in the proper direction to reach their goal without circumnavigating Earth. Kane subsided into his chair. He felt a vast expanse of weariness open like a chasm beneath him. But he wasn't ready to give in yet. There were questions to ask. The trickiest was which one to ask first.
What holds us up?
Big pardon?
Warboom Ben was surfing the help menus again. At the rate he was going, give him another 5 minutes and he'd know more about the damn airplane than the men who built it.
Into the air. Why do we fly? Lifting body shape doesn't make us float.
Oh, helium, Mr. Kane, helium. Most of this bird's empty space, you see. All filled with helium. Divided up into many small compartments, though, so it won't go all whooshing out when there's a leak.
Helium?
Oh, yeah. Clearly your designers were trying to emulate the hybrid's anti-gravity devices on the cheap. So they created a whacking great lighter-than-aircraft, a lifting body zeppelin.
But blimps, dirigibles, they're slow. We studied some about them in flight training. Why can we go fast?
Lightweight synthetics. Bones and skin of the aircraft. She's like a bird, Mr. Kane. Mostly air. Or, as I said, in this case, helium. Because she's rigid and hard-skinned, and because the EM field cuts out air friction, she can move along at quite a pretty clip.
I see. One thing?
Yes, Mr. Kane.
Don't call me Mr. Kane.
He looked at Johnny.
Something's not right here. They must have been using this craft to shuttle sandcats here for the invasion. How much can this thing carry, Ben?
100 tons, the specs claim. Don't know if that might not be a hair optimistic, but one never knows.
Whoa. So they wouldn't even need many trips to bring the war wags here, nor get them to Australia, come to that. But we've put a crimp in that plan anyway.
I hate to be the vulture at the feast, mate, but they might have another craft like this one. And there's the Varuna.
The God King's giant-ass gilded barge. What about it?
As we indicated when we passed it up in the harbour, she's not what she seems. She is, in fact, a hydrofoil cargo ship. She could carry a number of those vehicles and crews for them across to Northern Oz in a matter of hours herself.
Kane sank down in his seat.
Oh, this just keeps getting better and better. Well, we have something concrete to report now, anyway. Looks like the God King's big recruitment drive is just a scam to cover up the real invasion.
Maybe not. They want to conquer Australia, I bet. So they need bodies. Ones with swords and spears do fine for most purposes. Bowmen and swordsmen and all like that for actual attack. Pack them in the sandcats for cannon fodder, back them up with some bad boys with blasters, and heavy blasters on wags themselves. Plus, hey, they can train the locals to shoot auto blasters. Not that hard. Point and click. Bang, bang, bang.
So instead of a nice leisurely sailing voyage to invade Australia with a bunch of infantry waving garden tools, the God King is getting ready to hit the beach with a mechanized battalion. Can your people resist?
Johnny and Ben exchanged looks. Johnny's smile was conspicuous by its absence.
We will, but it'll do small good. We have few firearms. Most of our weapons are war booms and spears and the like. Frankly, not as effective as theirs.
What about your beam whips?
Man, don't have enough to do much good yet. Can't turn them out quick enough. Even though we borrowed enough parts from North America and elsewhere to put together a few machine shops of our own. And part of the knowledge we've lost consists of how to make better ones quicker. Ones that don't take so much out of the man who shoots them, for one thing.
A moment of silence ensued, pierced only by the muted engine sounds. The anti-turbulence field apparently eliminated or greatly reduced wind noise as well.
No help for it. Our mates in North America have to find the turtle soon and return it to Lilga. Or it's a long, dark night ahead for us all.
Look on the bright side. We have their super high-speed, low-drag, stealth cargo blimp. It's got webs, if nothing else. We're almost home free, and once we link back up with your old man and Lakesh, we can work out some scheme to slow the invaders down a bit.
The aircraft has just entered supersonic regime.
Cool, it talks!
When should we rise Uluru?
The craft seems to like a cruising speed around 1,000 knots. That makes it...
She looked up as an oblong cursor appeared on a big screen, white with crosshairs and emulating the display on her individual monitor, then moved down and left to the middle of the mass of Australia. Landmark names glowed alive in yellow as the cursor came near them, pre-dark villes such as Darwin and Catherine. Alice Springs appeared near the center, then the McConnell Ranges. Domi shifted the cursor down and left until Ayers Rock sprang up. She centered the cursor on that and clicked. It disappeared, and the legend Ayers Rock turned white and commenced to blink.
How'd you know where Allura was?
I made Bridget show me on a map after we got back.
Cruising speed attained. 1,000 knots.
Domi clicked more buttons.
Initiating autopilot. Destination Ayers Rock. Estimated time of arrival, 58 minutes and 23 seconds.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Kane let himself sprawl in the seat and laced his fingers behind his head.
As for me, I intend to celebrate the success of our hair-raising escape by taking a nice nap.
Though he was so fatigued he was sick to his stomach and his head felt like a lead balloon, he found himself unable to do more than doze fitfully for 10 or 15 minutes. Domi, on the other hand, had curled up in her chair and conked right out. She now lay on her right side, snoring softly and drooling onto the back of her hand. She looked adorable, even to the hardened Kane.
Beg pardon, gents, lady, but we seem to be being pursued by a flying saucer.
The sea below was giving way to yellow beach fringing sear brown land. They had reached the Australian coast. Kane kicked the side of Domi's chair.
Wake the red blast up, Domi. Damn scout disc is chasing us.
Domi snapped upright, clutching for her hands-on throttle and stick controls. The great black skycraft seemed to bounce left and upward. A ruby lance sliced across the sky to starboard of them.
What made you dodge?
Instinct.
Domi adjusted the angle of the aft-mounted vidcam. In a moment, its display showed the characteristic silver disc, apparently hanging in space behind them.
Hey, Tyree, maybe you could shoot back?
Have done. Dead center the bastard, too. No joy.
Is it time to start figuring out where they stow stuff like parachutes and inflatable life rafts in this thing? Presuming they do, of course.
Might not be necessary, Kane.
If you've got good news, don't keep it to yourself.
We can jerry-rig Ben's neutron beam weapon to draw upon the laser's power supply. That might put the disc out of commission.
You can do that with a hand web? Won't it overload?
Yep. So we'll need to make it count.
Kane became aware of someone standing beside his chair. He jumped in his seat and his head spun around. His sin eater slapped his hand. It was an old Aborigine man with short white hair and a beard. A very old-seeming man. Indeed, it was...
Old man!
Both Johnny Korobori and Warboom Ben gushed forth greetings in their ancient tongue. After a polite nod in the direction of the four staring eyes possessed by Kane and Domi, the ancient spoke quickly and quietly to his compatriots.
Domi, please keep driving.
Things just hanging back.
She turned her attention to the screen. She began to make the giant craft swerve and juke across the sky. Ben the tech boy took off down the passageway at a gangling run. Old man turned back to Kane, who had let his hand blaster go back in its holster, smiled politely, nodded, and disappeared.
What the hell?
We draw near, old man. His power here is great enough to project his likeness.
Another line of coherent ruby brilliance split the sky directly overhead.
How can they miss us? We're Earth's fattest target.
Kane observed on the display that they were also rapidly bleeding airspeed as Domi maneuvered, a necessary concomitant. Indeed, even the huge airship would become remarkably more maneuverable as it dropped below supersonic, and after all, it wasn't as if they had a prayer of outrunning the disc craft.
Probably not trying to hit us, Kane. Just want to force us down.
Oh. Johnny, are we close enough so old man can use his mystic juju to flash blast the saucer?
Johnny shrugged. The huge aircraft began dancing all over the sky, left, right, up, down, porpoising, wallowing around the central axis. Kane gripped tightly to the padded arms of his seat.
How the hell are you doing that, Domi?
Not! Found pre-programmed evasive routine for computer pilot. File name, Last Ditch.
Last Ditch routine in session. Good luck.
That's encouraging.
He was used to going into aerial battle with his destiny, his own personal black-clad magistrate ass, in another's hands. He couldn't help but grin at what Grant would make of putting it that way. But it was true. Over the years and many missions into the very heart of darkness, Outland style, Grant had flown the Deathbird and Kane had been a passenger. Aircraft commander granted, able to shoot at the bad guys, sure. But all that stood between Kane and a grease fire smoldering down in the weeds was Grant's wizard skill and intuition as a Deathbird jock. As avid a driver as she was, Domi was not in Grant's class piloting a fat Delta airship. But then, who alive would be? The canopy lit again with ruby reflection and that weird distinctive clarity and keenness that denoted coherent light.
We got problems?
Domi was flashing through the screens again, almost as fast as one of their Australian companions.
Yes and no.
What the hell kind of answer is that?
Thermal sensors show they just scorched some polycarb skin off the port wing upper surface, about midway between tip and centerline. No real harm, not even much increased drag.
Then what's with the yes problem bit?
Damn it, Kane, just let me fly!
Perhaps the young lady simply means they didn't miss.
Another flash. The big craft moved sideways. It seemed in response to the hit, not the evasion routine.
What the hell smacked us? Lasers have no impact.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh? What uh-oh? What the hell does uh-oh mean?
They hauled one of our helium cells on the starboard wing. We're venting gas.
They trying to destroy us or just force us down?
Maybe don't care. Shut up!
Tyree, Ben, how are you coming back there?
We haven't forgotten our friends following behind.
The seat fell away beneath Kane. His stomach seemed to jump into his throat.
Shit! Bad one! Put big gash in starboard wing upper!
We going down?
But the dirigible had already ceased its elevator with snapped cable downward thrill ride.
Not yet. But we've lost top-end speed and are losing buoyancy. They're getting serious!
Another flash. And another. The great vessel rocked as huge glowing holes were burned in its non-reflective black hide. It possessed, Kane guessed, self-sealing mechanisms in the gas cells, possibly even means to generate more gas, more lift. But he knew with cold surety that whatever means it had of repairing itself and keeping Skyborne, Domi and the flight computer were already maxing them out. Kane glanced at the ground down the vast black slope of the starboard wing. He could see one tear and wrenched his eyes away. The desert looked conspicuously closer. He looked at the altimeter. They had been cruising at an altitude of 10 miles into the stratosphere, where the big ship just trucked along, since unlike a conventional aircraft which relied on its wings for lift, there was no downside to the thinning air, and hence lessening resistance to their forward flight. But they had already lost half that. They were little more than 16,000 feet up now, and the altimeter readout was flickering too fast to read, all in distinctly the wrong direction.
How much could she take?
Kane was trying to ignore the brilliant red flashes now, even if he felt each one like a shock stick to his scrotum.
Triple buttload. She triple big, triple strong. Problem is, they can dish that out and more.
Ruby glare filled the cockpit and instantly dimmed. The canopy's clear synthetic had darkened automatically to prevent laser blinding of the aircrew. A possibility for a beam that incredibly potent, even as reflected, scattered coherent light. The streak of darkness on the canopy faded. Long before it was gone, Kane could see the raw wound the laser had left in the fuselage right next to the control compartment, edges glowing yellow-hot like lava.
We losing it big time. Ben, Tyree!
Almost got it, Domi. Hold her up just a moment longer.
The violence of the airship's maneuvering had steadily decreased since the silvery saucer started firing for effect against the fleeing dirigible. Now it was doing little more than a queasy wallow.
Do what I can. Let me know when you're ready, then haul ass! I give you 5 seconds to get clear, then boom, she goes!
Right, lass.
Domi didn't react, but Kane looked sharply at the speaker.
They're closing!
Kane's eyes flashed to the display showing the feed from the rear vid pickup. The scout disc looked twice as big as it did before.
Going for the kill shot.
Hello!
The impact whiplashed the three in the cockpit. The immense craft bucked and skidded like a sand cat on ice. Fortunately, the airship still had positive buoyancy. Otherwise, they would have died, and that was that. It still wanted to stay up more than it wanted to plow a giant furrow in the red-brown dirt of Australia. Barely. The image returned to the screen as Domi restored a semblance of control to the airship's flight. The angle seemed slightly different. Kane guessed the first pickup had been knocked out and slack taken up automatically by another cam. The silver disc had dwindled again to almost the size it had been during most of the one-sided dogfight. But that wasn't all. It wobbled like a wood chip on a wind-blown pond, and a great incandescent wound in its silver skin bled black and purple smoke. A flash. Blue-white beam shot from the saucer ship's interior. Mirror shards peeled off the top of the disc and glittered away. The scout disc was yawing madly now, erupting smoke and jets of dazzling fire. It began a mad plunging up and down, then reared abruptly back as three fresh explosions flashed from inside. Then a white fireball simply consumed the craft. It turned into a comet of smoke and debris, the smoke first black, then white as it followed them a moment longer, then slowed. Debris began to rain on the gray-green scrublands below.
Yes!
All right!
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo! All right!
What about Tyree and Ben?
Johnny's gentle inquiry snapped them back to reality. Domi didn't even have to touch her keyboard. The answer glowed on the displays.
Gone.
You mean radiation from the overload?
I mean gone.
A new graphic appeared, a three-dimensional schematic of the craft. A dozen breaches showed on the wide delta shape like strokes of a pen with luminous scarlet ink. But what snapped up the eye was a great red cup-shaped depression in the center of the airship's stern, like a bite taken out from between the driving ducts.
Bastards in the saucer must have spotted Ben and Tyree aiming the sting web at them. They were closing to flash blast the weapon bubble.
They and our boys must have fired simultaneously.
They never had a chance.
Kane reached out to clasp her chalk-white hand gently in his big, sun-darkened, scarred one. She came half out of her seat to cling to him and sob.
They never meant to. All along, they intended to shoot the overload beam the microsecond it was ready.
He looked out at the landscape, now seemingly about to climb into the cabin with them.
Thank God they did.
Domi recovered rapidly enough to resume the nerve-grinding task of trying to shepherd the big craft to Uluru. Inexorably, it lost both altitude and airspeed. Yet there were tiny advantages to be seen and seized. Domi found out the craft's sensors could somehow detect thermals ahead, and the warm air upwellings, fountaining invisibly against the vast matte-black underside of the craft, actually pushed it back up into the sky, a few hundred feet's grace gained each time. But it was a fight she and the Valiant ship were bound to lose. The real question was whether they could keep from hitting the planet too far from Uluru to survive a trek across the desert. Johnny Korobori still retained the desert survival skills of the personality born into his current body. Indeed, attuned to Jakurpa as he was, all 75,000 years of skills, with some gaps, or so Kane guessed. But he knew he wasn't up for a long, hot wilderness hike in his present condition. And who knew what shape they'd be in after what he strove optimistically to think of as their landing. When the McConnells rose before them, they were clearly below the tops of the peaks. The flight computer, it seemed, had terrain-following skills, and Domi had a few of her own, if born mostly of sheer desperation. She quickly discovered that the altitude jets could be used to counteract the G's of lift that tried to push them into a turn in even a vertical bank between cliffs, so that she could whip the thing on edge to pass through a space that would have shattered it otherwise, without veering into one of the very unyielding stone masses she sought to avoid. The mothership's positive buoyancy, dwindling though it still steadily was, kept them from dropping as precipitously as a conventional craft does when banked 90 degrees, with no lift opposing gravity's steady pull. So Domi and the flight computer together threw a giant machine through maneuvers that threatened to turn Kane's stomach inside out at the same time they threatened his very sanity. The lighter-than-air craft, huge and mortally injured though she was, could perform stunts that would have meant instant blazing death in a heavier-than-air machine, fixed or rotary wing. And so, seesawing left and right, and somehow even squeezing a few extra inches of altitude from rising air masses near obstacles that rose in their path, they came safely through the mountains. Sitting, if that was the word, only his safety harness kept Kane from oozing into a puddle on the deck. In his seat, utterly spent, Kane became aware that the white on-screen circle that was their destination was bigger and brighter and pulsing more insistently. Johnny snapped forward in his seat.
There! Uluru!
Kane saw it, just a hump rising from the desert floor.
I see it.
Domi was slumped in the pilot seat. The tension of the running flight and the heart-stopping passage through the mountains had sucked the energy, practically the life, from her slight body. She seemed barely more substantial than a ghost. She adjusted the magnification on the display showing the view from ahead. The great rock halfway filled the screen. Its angled oblong mass had gone gray with the onset of early afternoon.
My people!
There were structures of some sort visible near the base of the huge boulder.
I'm going for it. I think I can put us down almost at the foot of the damn rock. Sorry, Johnny.
His smile was a shadow of its former self.
No worries, Tommy.
You think you can make it? If there's a tall goat in our path, we'll knock him on his ass as it is.
No goats, Kane. Australia, remember?
Kangaroo, then. Oh, and don't plow through the camp if you can help it.
It seemed like forever before they actually reached Uluru. As with a helicopter, the mothership depended little on airspeed to stay airborne. All the same, Kane felt the speed trickling away as if it were his own lifeblood leaking from his veins. What was their lifeblood leaking away was altitude. Uluru was clearly visible on the wide screen now, getting visibly bigger. But even as it did, the ground got nearer and nearer. Kane kept waiting to feel the scrape of rock on the bottom of the hull. He tried not to tense in anticipation. It didn't help, and in a crash might get him hurt worse. Of course, there was no telling in this case whether relaxation on impact would make the stellar difference between triple-chilled and merely double-chilled.
We're gonna make it! Yes!
Steer away to port, Domi. We're too close to the camp.
With an obedient hiss, the altitude jets turned the airship's nose. But it took time for the drive jets, pushing them in a new direction, to overcome the inertia, driving their substantial mass straight on the way they had been going. Kane actually forgot to worry about hitting the ground out of concern they would wipe out Johnny's people. The talker himself tactfully refrained from comment, but his rigid posture told the whole tale. Then their true course shifted, at last, to clear the tents and stone structures. It was a good-sized ville, far more structures than Bridget, Domi, and Shizuka had recounted seeing. And then their broad black belly did kiss the desert. A grinding scrape, just what Kane had been dreading to hear, thrilled right up his spine. Still slightly buoyant, the mothership skipped off the earth like a stone.
Oh, shit.
She clearly hadn't been expecting that particular trick. The big swollen delta was nose up and soaring back into the sky, with both lifting body shape and helium conspiring against their safe return to Earth. Domi pressed buttons. The attitude blowers began to drive the big rounded nose back toward the planet. Then the hissing stopped.
Damn! Compressor's gone. Try angling the drive nozzles.
At her command, the two-dimensional ducts vectored thrust downward to drive the tail up and the nose down. Unfortunately, the dirigible, after trying for the last few hours to fall out of the sky, now stubbornly resisted returning to Earth.
Poppy fuck! Dumping helium, damn it!
Will that work?
Are you sure that's a good idea?
No.
The airship began to fall.
We land now, one way or other.
Johnny turned to them and flashed his biggest, brightest smile.
Kane, Domi, it's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
Me too.
They hit. The three occupants were thrown about like rag dolls in their seats, but their safety straps held. The mothership's nose dropped right back down and it plowed once more into the ground. A great bow wave of tan soil was thrown up to either side. The friction braked them so quickly that they were thrown forward against their harnesses. So quickly that Kane dared hope.
Looks like we're through the worst of it.
Then the underside of the dirigible's nose struck a buried sandstone shoal. For a moment, it seemed the titanic hurtling mass would stop dead. The breath was blasted out of Kane as he was shot against his harness like a bullet from a blaster. He felt metal straining and trying to shear in the clamps holding his padded seat in place. Johnny's couch broke free. At the same instant, the dirigible's nose rode up and over the obstruction and the craft slid onward, grinding across the desert amid a cacophony of destruction. Kane saw Johnny's seat slam into the windscreen. The whole view forward vanished behind a curtain of dark, dark red. Then Kane's world went black. He opened his eyes to a sky that seemed to be half green, half purple. It was illuminated by a wan, yellowish glare.
Hell needs a new interior decorator.
My hopes for your full and prompt recovery soar.
A familiar voice came from somewhere to the left of the pounding mass of ache that was his head, as differentiated from the giant insistent throb of pain that was his whole body.
That my excellent friend Kane greets his return to consciousness with a witticism.
It seemed as if Kane could feel every one of his prior incarnations. They all hurt, too.
Luckish. That settles it. If I'm chilled, this is hell. But Domi missed the vill, so I must be alive.
He cranked his eyeballs left. It seemed that they actually ratcheted in their sockets. Dr. Mohandas Lakesh Singh sat beside the pallet on which Kane lay in a folding wood and synthetic chair. The glow of the kerosene lantern danced yellow on his head. He held a tall glass of dark fluid in one hand, with ice in it, no less, and a fur of condensation wrapping it. Beside him sat a familiar white-bearded form, grinning all over its seamed aborigine face.
Where is Domi?
Here.
He turned his face that way, although his neck vertebrae all seemed to have spikes. Domi, clad in a man's blue chambray shirt, faded nearly as white as her skin, and, if Kane was any judge, nothing else, sat cross-legged on another thin mattress or pallet beside him. She cupped her own tall glass of iced beverage in both her tiny pale hands.
Glad you made it. What about Johnny?
Old man's smile faded. He shook his white head slowly.
Fuck.
Kane turned his face back up toward the joining of unlikely colored panels directly overhead. His eyes stung. No doubt it was smoke drifting in from the fires outside.
What the plague is that you're drinking?
Iced tea? A most delightful beverage of your world. Would you like some?
Ice? Where do hunter-gatherers get ice? In the middle of the desert?
As I suspect you've gathered, Kane, these people are not simple hunter-gatherers, or at least are no longer.
Yeah, and the old dude sitting next to you seems to have them dancing like puppets on a string.
Kane turned his head to glare at the two elders.
Just like us, ever since he snatched you.
My good friend, old man, has been forced to expedients he finds most distasteful, as we ourselves so frequently do.
Distasteful? That's just not good enough. Son of a bitch has a lot to answer for.
He sprang. From somewhere, the raging depths of his anger, his abused body and limbs found strength to snap him upright. In a panther bound, he was behind Old Man, wrapping his bare arm around his neck. Around nothing. Old Man still sat there, beaming beatifically. Kane's arm had clenched through his neck and against his own triceps.
Oh, dear. Have you not realized all we see of Old Man is a holographic projection?
Kane toppled forward, through the old man, over his chair, and back into black.
So, you call to seek my assistance, Mother?
Erica Van Sloan sucked in her breath. The sibilance from the screen, which was white with a single, simple Chinese ideogram glowing upon it in red, was almost foreign to her. Yet somehow she recognized the voice of her son.
Yes, Sam.
You admit to failure yet again.
He is on the other side of the world, she told herself, forcing herself to aspirate slowly and evenly. I am here, in the midst of my stronghold, surrounded by fighters loyal to me. She knew that the possibility existed that none of that might matter in the slightest, yet she certainly had reason to believe her son's powers to be severely curtailed. At least his more mystic powers. She was hoping, on the basis of something slightly more substantial than sheer wishfulness, that his temporal power might be greater than he had let on for a time.
Please don't play games with me, Sam. This is not properly my task. It isn't taking place in North America. Why won't you let me see you?
Because I choose not to. You look well, Mother. It appears age has not caught up with you. As yet.
You've played that card too often, Sam.
Perhaps I have. Perhaps I have. The multiverse weighs heavily on my mind these days. I find it difficult sometimes to concentrate on the merely mundane, not to mention the tedious.
The matter at hand is not precisely mundane.
Of course not. Why else would I consent to receive your call, Mother dearest? Do you know what the hour is here?
A little after 10 in the morning. It's night here.
Ah, so it is. But I toyed with you. In fact, I had no notion of the hour, nor whether the sun stands in the sky above or not. It is days since I have seen the sun.
I need your help.
Indeed you do. And I am to share in the prize?
You always were.
I believe, should I decide to help you, my direct participation entitles me to a larger share. We shall speak of this later. Now, tell me, did you expect better from the ludicrous Thulia?
I expect nothing at all from that one. I sent him as a sop to the other barons who'd prefer him dead. They think he's a fool. They're right, of course.
She ran a hand through her long, heavy, midnight black hair.
I expected more from the strange baron-class hybrid who calls himself the God King.
And more, she would not admit, from Vladek. Although if the God King's own sect chief and viceroy had betrayed them, perhaps in truth there was little her hand-picked magistrate could have done. Which was why she had refrained from sending more mags to haul him back in manacles. And then again, she admitted to herself, if I destroy my magistrates whenever the bastard Kane gets the better of them, I'll soon run out.
His faction came off second best in the Civil War after unification. Yet the losers of that conflict have not done too badly for themselves. All things taken with all things, What is it you would have of me, Mother?
We lost the hall.
The heavy advanced utility lifter, yes. And something else as well.
The God King's scout disc, as you obviously know. Somehow Cain and his savage friends pulled off the impossible again. The hall carried no weapons capable of bringing down a saucer.
But your heavy lifter has served its purpose, has it not? Surely it transferred sufficient Sandcat AVFs from the North American baronies to disperse the primitives and seize the technological treasure they have stolen?
It transferred them to Tanimbar. The God King wanted them all assembled there before staging to Australia. He feared if he tried transporting them piecemeal from North America to Australia directly, the savages would find some way to interfere.
He has gathered a mighty surface fleet.
Junks and prows. 1 in 100, perhaps, with a working engine. Varuna cannot carry all the Sandcats at once, much less with crews and modern weapons for our shock troops. Meanwhile, the savages must be getting closer to that which they seek. We dare not endure the delay of sailing everything across to North Australia.
And you think I can help you? If I could simply wave my hand and teleport them all to Australia, would I be rusticating here in the charming company of Qin Shi Huang Di's jade-enshrouded mummy?
No.
Erica quailed inside at the acid trip his tone had taken. At least her will had iron enough left in it to keep it from showing in her features or voice, she thought.
But I think you have assets. Material assets, which might be of great assistance.
Why, Mother dear, so you know about my Akrano plans?
From a secret subterranean base near Vladivostok, two craft set forth south across the Sea of Japan. As ungainly as they were unlikely in appearance, they would have been the largest conventional aircraft ever built, surpassing even Howard Hughes' infamous Spruce Goose in size and carrying capacity. Had they been aircraft. But they could never fly. Their wings were stubs, ludicrously out of proportion to their vast-bellied bulk, never large enough to lift them into the sky. But enough to lift them 20 yards or so above the water's surface, riding in the dense ground effect. Like hovercraft, they were GEVs. More boat than airplane, capable of the speed of a 4-engine cargo plane for a fraction of the fuel consumption. They had a great distance to travel, past the ruins of the Korean Peninsula and the Japanese home islands, to the far South Seas. But most of their immense lifting capacity was currently devoted to fuel, ample fuel to carry them and their crews to their destination in a flight lasting nearly 24 hours. From Tanimbar, they would help Varuna shuttle the Dewa Raja's Blitzkrieg Battalion to northern Australia in the matter of another day or two. The bulk of his forces, some 20,000 men, armed with their more primitive weaponry, would follow at their leisure in the ragged surface fleet. Those troops would be sufficient to occupy the country and hunt down the remnants of the savages after the specially trained and armed shock troops and their magistrate cadres, Sandcat-born, had scattered them and seized the secret of Uluru, which had dared defy Erica Van Sloan once and would never be permitted to do so a second time. 4 of the bizarre, not-quite-flying machines had been built. 2 had survived somehow and fallen into the possession of servants of Sam the Imperator by secret, doubtful means. They were the last of the Caspian Sea monsters. They were Akronoplans. The armbrust shuddered once, hard, on Domi's shoulder as it ejected the plastic reaction mass out of its fat, flared rear. As plastic petals deployed from the countermass and eased it to Earth, the anti-tank rocket's engine kicked in. The rocket accelerated noiselessly, flashlessly, and almost smokelessly toward the rear of the Sandcat. The rear ramp of the armored wag fell open. Blazing figures staggered out, their waving arms like wings with flames for feathers. The lead Sandcat, which had rolled on in advance of the little convoy to reconnoiter an obvious ambush point where the dry wash they followed passed between 2 outcrops of big green boulders, pivoted adroitly by reversing one set of tracks while rolling the other forward. It started to trundle back. The USMG 73 heavy machine gun set in its cupola, protected by the armorglass bubble, stuttered and flamed, seeking Domi's life. As she turned to leap down to safety behind the ridge, she saw a gusher of dust erupt from the mound of boulders on the cat's right. Whether the tons of rock and rubble displaced by the blast, command detonated by members of the Aborigine ambush unit Domi led, crushed the wag or merely dropped in its path, she didn't know. But the machine gun's deep-throated snarl ceased. She heard blaster fire popping as she ran down the back slope, slipping on scree, and snagged up a second Armbrust launcher by its strap. There was still a good deal of screaming going on from the burning rifle squad from the wag she'd blasted, or the freshly hurt. She reached level ground, raced toward the ridge's abrupt trail end. She hoped the half-repressed birth personalities of the small band she led currently dominated the recovered crew personae. The hunter-gatherer aborigines were masters of stealth and surprise. The crew folk, spaceborn, were not. There was nothing wrong with their valor. That, so far as Domi was concerned, was their problem. She herself, with her true feral child's utter lack of a sense of fair play toward enemies, was a born guerrilla. And the first precept of every successful guerrilla throughout history was to run away. Guerrilla warfare, as she knew instinctively, was the recourse of the weak. Cowardice was the guerrilla's cardinal virtue. She came around the butt of the rise from whose top she had blasted the rear guard fighting wag. It still blazed enthusiastically. The men who had emerged from it now lay in smoldering heaps. Men with blasters had leaped from the three remaining wags and begun to fire back from the ground. As Domi watched, several of her warriors stood along the top of the far ridge, firing long blasters from the hip, of all things trying to get a better angle at the prone invaders. From an improvised hardpoint atop the long, silver, squashed cylinder tank of the fuel wag, a machine gun opened up. The three raiders were knocked down like bottles from a fence. The God King's goons had learned from the previous raid she had planned and frequently led, Domi reflected. Or maybe they just watched an old Road Warrior vid. She prepped the rocket launcher, knelt, shouldered it, and aimed at the rear of the big bloated metal maggot glistening in the desert sun. It was late afternoon, so the convoy sect man would have had all day to bake in the enervating North Australian early summer heat and get tired and cranky and slow. Although tens of thousands of aborigines were streaming toward Uluru from all over the landmass, many having recovered their crew identities, or in process of doing so, they had pitifully few modern arms and fewer still of the neutron beam hand blasters, which the Sandcats were proof against anyway. Their traditional weps would chill a man as sure as a bullet or a blue bolt, sure, but range and firepower matter. The brutal fact was that for all that they greatly outnumbered the invaders, the aborigines stood no chance of contesting their advance. Not in fair fights, nor even by attacking their leading elements, although booby traps and ambushes did what they could to make them cautious and slow them. But the ambushes were proving as deadly to the teams who sprang them as to their ostensible victims, which hadn't dented the aborigines' willingness to volunteer for them, to try and die. Domi admired that, but wild child that she was, she reserved her deepest regard for those who kicked the enemy where it hurt and got away clean to hurt them again. Anyway, the invasion's armored spearhead was its least vulnerable part. Their weakness was their endlessly increasing supply train, dragging food, water, ammunition, and most of all fuel across hundreds of desert cliques. That was their jugular. Even with the aid of the painfully few Farwalkers, Domi had no realistic hope of cutting it for any protracted period. But she and her two brave raiders could squeeze it, slow the relentless, remorseless, resistless advance for a time. Whether that was worth the sacrifice depended on one thing only. Did it buy enough time for Bridget and Grant's team to track down the elusive turtle and get it back to Lilga? Domi got the big, bright bug in the crosshairs of her simple optic sight. Its dorsal MG raked the slopes, sheer reconnaissance by fire. She knew none of her people hid there. She pressed the trigger. Motion caught the corner of her eye as a man in a black turban rose from the scrub not 7 yards away, aiming a Kalashnikov at her. His beard split in a snag-toothed smile. The ball rolled up to bump to a stop against the toe of Kane's right boot. He stooped, picked it up, and turned to the little girl in the gunny sack frock who was following it.
Hi, Lilga. Hinting, are we?
I wondered if you might want to play with me today, Mr. Kane.
Kane tossed her the ball. She caught it deftly, cupping her small toast-brown hands.
Yes, I would like to play, but later.
He strode on toward the command tent, where, as always, Old Man and Lakesh could be found, plotting and trying to one-up each other. Part of Kane looked forward to the coming interview. He had never encountered or even imagined someone who could get over on Lakesh as consistently as the Aborigines' eldest could. It drove Lakesh crazy to come out second in the Omniscience Derby, and of course he could never let on that he had. It was pure joy to watch. Passing Lilga, who now stood smiling cheerfully up at him, He paused to ruffle her mop of pale brown curls. These were the happiest people he'd ever encountered. Not that there'd been much competition where he'd grown up in the enclaves of Cobaltville, and it was manifestly genuine. They maintained it, as he had seen, in the face of certain death, and Lilga seemed to have the sunniest disposition of all. All the others who came in contact with her deferred to her, at least adults. Children don't do deference well, even when sternly instructed to at least try to show respect. But even the other Aborigine kids treated Lilga as if she were special. Yet she never acted as if she expected it. Cain had never seen her anything but friendly and happy. It made him feel old and encrusted in scars thick as rhinoceros hide. He ducked down and pushed aside the tent flap. A chill air blast caught him in the face. Old Man had some means of climate controlling the interior, although Cain neither saw nor heard traces of a fan or compressor or anything else to account for it. For his part, he refused to accord Old Man the satisfaction of asking, a habit he'd learned well dealing with Lakesh.
"Greetings, friend Cain."
Cain straightened, allowing the flap to fall behind him and cut off the furnace blast of the late day outside.
"I trust we find you well?"
"My wounds have all healed up, yeah."
Pretending to sit in a chair, Old Man turned to Lakesh, who sat beside him at the folding camp table.
"He chafes at what he perceives as his captivity. A meddlesome young man, Lakesh."
"He is indeed. Yet do not be tempted to underestimate him. He is at least occasionally capable of tempering his brashness and impetuous nature with keen insight."
"You sent for me. Was there anything beyond watching you two polish up your comedy routine? Because if that's all, I can go back to doing something vital, like kicking over rocks around camp to see if any God King's elite chill squads are hiding under them."
"It is not from caprice that we have urgently desired you to remain here. We must remain alive to the possibility of a strike by our foes."
"Bullshit. Your tech boy geeks and girl farwalkers have balls bigger than most Coldheart's heads. Your bull boys are more than capable of flash-blasting any raid that Dewa Raja is likely to mount. Unless they hit us with an airstrike, and so far, we've seen no sign they even have death birds, much less any more saucers."
Cain was in truth intimidated by Old Man, a little scared of him, given what just the rank-and-file Aborigine seemed capable of. It was no reason for Cain to defer to him. Quite the opposite in his mind.
"The logistics of maintaining helicopters in the desert at the end of a supply chain half the circumference of Earth in length likely prohibit our enemies deploying them. They find sufficient difficulty keeping their surface transport mobile, thanks especially to the inspired efforts of our dear Domi."
"Yeah, she's white death, and no mistake. I just don't see why I'm not out there lending a hand."
"Well, in truth, it was Dr. Sang who insisted on keeping you close."
Lakesh's purloined blue eyes shot a quick dagger his colleague's way.
"But your time for action may have come, friend Cain."
Cain arched a skeptical brow and crossed his arms over his chest.
"Oh, so?"
"Despite your friend Domi's truly impressive skills, and despite the efforts of our fighters to slow them, the invaders draw near Uluru. They have almost won through the Tanami Desert. We now must move the bulk of our people south to the shelter of the Musgrave Ranges."
The camp population had swelled enormously in just the week or so he and Domi had been there. Over 100,000 Aborigines, he guessed, had to be gathered in the shadow of the great rock that was the symbolic heart of their people, and apparently more from what Brigid and the other women had experienced, and from the invaders' stone determination to seize it. To say they traveled light was an understatement. They came naked, or nearly so, bearing nothing personal but a few spears and knives and blasters. Mostly they carried food and water. As Cain understood it, the Aborigines had little attachment to physical possessions, and whatever they had possessed before now belonged to a life they were leaving behind. One way or another, he thought grimly.
"Won't be easy, moving that many people."
"They moved here readily enough, despite hardship. We are harder folk, well adjusted to our environment."
"I know. You've had long enough to adapt. What about Grant and Baptiste, their team?"
Lakesh and the Elder exchanged glances.
"Dear Brigid believes they are closing in upon the turtle."
"With all due respect, Baptiste's felt that way before."
"Just so. But Rita, their farwalker, believes they have adjusted their thought patterns properly so that the turtle will now seek to be found instead of seeking to remain concealed.
It's got in the habit of hiding just like the rest of us. Amazing how set one gets in one's ways after just a few hundred centuries.
In one flash, Domi resigned herself to death. She triggered the anti-tank rocket launcher. A whirling darkness struck the back of the blaster's turbaned head. He fell forward, discharging a burst not into Domi's unprotected flesh, but into the ground at his feet. The tanker truck turned into a miniature yellow sun. Domi dived back around the curve of the ridge as flame ballooned toward her. An instant later, a wiry Aborigine youth tumbled down next to her. The flames didn't reach so far, but Dragon's Breath eddied around the rock to caress them, reeking of burning petroleum, and their ears popped as the dynamic overpressure rolled past them. The young warrior, dressed in a camo shirt and loincloth, grinned at her in triumph. The name he used was a crew name, with rising, falling tones like Chinese and phonemes Domi couldn't even fit her mind around, much less try to pronounce. He answered to Rig, an abbreviation of sorts.
So much for them.
For some unknowable reason, he spoke with an American accent, which was to say, no accent Domi could detect. She grinned and they exchanged high fives.
Come on! Help me hunt up our survivors and farwalk our fannies out of here. It's time for the run away and live to fight again another day part.
Kane's gray eyes narrowed, flickered from one to the other.
What really scares me is that I don't think you old guys are trying to be funny.
He sighed and let his arms drop.
What do you want me to do?
Keep the invaders from Uluru as long as possible. The rest of our people will go to a hidden camp in the mountains where the India waits.
Although Kane had rested up from his traumatic time in Tanimbar, he'd had little else to do other than rest and fret, with both Old Man and Lakesh insisting he stick close to camp. He suddenly felt infinite weariness flood into him.
What do I have to fight with?
You will have 10,000 fighters to assist you.
How many blasters?
Not quite 2,000. Our ammunition stocks are ample.
Blue bolters?
Fewer than 100.
Kane shook his head. Understand, please, we do not expect you to win.
Good, because we won't.
You must delay them as long as you can, Kane. All hangs upon it. More than I dare say you can imagine.
Old Man leaned forward. His seamed face seemed contoured into a very stylized mask of caring and concern. Kane figured it was a shuck.
Mr. Kane, please allow me to level with you.
If I can stand the novelty...
Boy now, your Annam Kara, your soul friend, Bridget Baptiste, has told you that our people do not spring from this Earth's past, but from its far distant future.
Kane nodded warily.
Yeah, another little detail you forgot to mention up front.
Kane, please understand. Our friends felt grave concern about loading us down with too much detail.
Yeah, I know all about their worry that if they told us too much truth, it'd make our savage little heads explode. Go on, old man.
You have heard how our fleet was destroyed in a great space battle against a potent force. A force that we can only call evil. A great, grave evil. We fled 75,000 years into your past and hundreds of thousands of years into our own to escape. And then concealed ourselves in such a way as to leave all but no trace of our once and future existence because nothing less had a chance to succeed.
And here you let us think it was the Anunnaki who whipped you.
We did. But remember the legend which Yindi, whom you have yet to meet, showed your friends. Some of the serpent folk were friendly to us, some unfriendly, like all that was revealed to Bridget Baptiste and Domi and Shizuka. That was true. Even if not the totality of the truth, which, of course, would take far more than a single human lifetime to convey, in fairness to us and our selectivity with it.
His smile returned, but briefly.
The Anunnaki are not the evil we fled, nor are the Tuatha De Danann, nor the Fomori, nor any of the alien races who have visited Earth in your past. Nor yet the Archons who sprang of the union of the Anunnaki and Danann, nor the hybrids they engendered with you humans. With us, I should say.
You're not human. I'd have to be triple stooped not to be aware of that.
But I am Old Man, the eldest of my people. You may believe, friend Kane, that the entirety of my existence has been devoted single-mindedly, and joyously, permit me to add, to serving and preserving them. Our primary concern has been to keep ourselves from the awareness of these races. Our deepest desire has been to slip away unnoticed. But the earlier invasion of our sacred mountain by Eric of Anslone and Baron Boussoleil and their men rendered that impossible, made it imperative we get away as quickly as possible without further regard for stealth. Yet, as I say, none of them is the evil that defeated us, will defeat us, our younger incarnations, which destroyed our fleet and dispersed our folk. Yet there is some connection which not even I can fairly ascertain. And there is a force abroad in this world today that may indeed bear some more intimate relation to that evil.
Those Chinese sect men in the underground hangar in Tanimbar. Sam, the Imperator.
Old man nodded slowly. Kane squinted.
You mean he evolves into this cosmic evil? 100,000 years in the future?
I do not know what role Sam might play in the evils coming into being and ripening to maturity. It may indeed be none. He may simply partake of similar evil, be touched and tainted with it. I tell you honestly, I do not know.
I don't have much reason to believe you, but I can't see it matters one way or another at this point.
You do not lack wisdom, as my esteemed friend Dr. Singh has divined. But one thing to keep in mind is that we crew folk are not the only ones who can move backward and forward through time, as well through the various alternate realities you have characterized as casements.
Thanks for sharing that information with me, since there's nothing on Earth or in Hell I can do about it.
Ha, but there is. Win time for your friends to bring back the title.
And that's going to help? What is it, some kind of double super wonder web to chill all the bad guys?
Much more than that.
Old man's face split into a vast, beaming smile.
Oh, much more. If we get it back, all will at once be made well, Kane, my dear young friend.
Kane's eyes went pale and narrowed to slits.
That doesn't mean it's going to enable you to just cruise away from Earth in this mystery starship of yours and leave us to eat lots of death?
I assure you it does not.
Believe him, Kane.
Yeah. You're both so trustworthy. Oh, well, not like I've got anything better to do.
He wheeled, started to walk out, but stopped at the tent flap.
It's a suicide mission, you know.
Yes, Kane, my beloved friend, it is a suicide mission. Yet if our friends do not return the Mackenzie Turtle to us before the God King and his minions enter Uluru, believe me, if you believe nothing else I ever say, those who fall quickly in battle, futile as their deaths may be, will be the lucky ones. Lucky beyond imagining.
The Varuna and the strange, stub-winged flying craft had shuttled the North American Sandcats and their crews, mostly locals crash-trained by Magistrate Cadre, to Australia in a matter of a day or so. Then they had continued their trips. Old soft-skinned wags, all of which surviving in the islands belonged to the God King by proclamation, supplies, sword and spear cannon fodder. Eventually, both the chronoplans had been attacked by suicide commandos far walked into them, one crippled, the other destroyed, crossing the Arafura Sea between Tanimbar and Oz. There had never been many far walkers among the crew, and while self-teleporting saboteurs and assassins were unstoppable, they simply could not do enough damage to justify the loss of their wild talents. Even if they eliminated the God King, and, incidentally, Thulia, whom the Dewa Raja kept always near him, not that any players in the game appeared to consider him anything but incidental, it would not stop the invasion. Eric of Anslone and the remaining barons in North America would press the attack with redoubled fury. Indeed, even the Farwalkers might not be unstoppable. Passing by the rear of their tent one day, Kane had overheard Lakesh and Old Man muttering together. Details escaped him, but he caught the distinct impression a small team sent to blow up Erica Van Sloan in her chambers in the Cobaltville monolith had simply vanished, tracelessly. Sam's powers had been sharply circumscribed since his failure to seize control of North America and the world, but apparently still enabled him to take particular care of his mother. In turn, Kane had wondered why, if Sam could interfere with that jump, he hadn't done more to actively counter the Aborigines. King decided that he had too little evidence and less understanding. Old Man was obviously a major hoodoo in his own right, with abilities to dwarf the scary powers Yindi let Baptiste and the other women see. Who knew what esoteric battles might be being waged beyond human perception? Whoever did, Kane reckoned, he'd be the last man on Earth to join them. He never doubted Old Man and his people were doing everything in their power to resist, but Domi's far-walking logistics raids were no more than pinpricks, and the invaders butchered out of hand any aborigines they encountered. Whether they fought back or not was immaterial.
Bit of a bother, what?
It was nighttime in what had been the American Southwest. The stars gleamed bright and seemed close in the high desert air. The six of them, four aborigines plus Grant and Bridget, stood in their bulky rad suits on a concrete-bordered island of seared dead soil with a buckled blacktop parking lot before them and a wide, much-buckled street behind them, gazing at the mostly collapsed Maxwell Museum of Anthropology in Albuquerque. The talker glanced down at the rad counter in his hand and shook his head.
Not a place to tarry, even in these suits.
At least we aren't likely to need to fight our way in or out.
Don't count on it.
The museum looked as if none too recently some large and intensely heavy object had landed on it from great height. At one point it had been a long, low box in the usual southwestern Pueblo-emulating style, rising to two stories back away and to the left of the six. Now it was sort of dented in, just north of center along its long axis. Whatever had done the damage, presumably during the nuke cost, had vanished. Leaving aside the lethal levels of gamma and neutron emissions, it was a pleasant autumn evening. From the brush that had reclaimed the rubble of houses to the west, a pack of coyotes yipped to each other as the moon rose above Sandia Peak. The explorers' own breathing echoed inside their polycarb rad suit helmets. Grant and Bridget wore shadow suits beneath. The aborigines had declined them. Supposedly, shadow armor was proof against radiation. Neither North American was inclined to trust that to any great extent, and both were unashamedly glad when they saw the actual rad levels here. Evidently, core fissiles from a fusion bomb, targeted probably against a main warhead storage facility in what had been the northern extremity of the city, now a vast, green-glass crater, had condensed out of vapor and drifted seriously right across this patch of the planet. I'm just happy to have the shadow armor as well as the rad suit, Bridget thought. The ground beneath their sealed boots, which, though tan soil, appeared to have the consistency of concrete, vibrated.
Tremor. All we fucking need.
The Earthshakers awakened a great deal of latent seismic activity in this part of the continent.
Nothing for it. Let's go on in.
Not all of us. Leave Bridget out. And Rita. Come to that, maybe just Navi and I should go in.
The talker shook his head, still smiling, but sadly.
Sorry, mate. We can't quite do that. Rita's best to find where the turtle's actually hiding, since she can sense it.
The walker nodded her helmet.
I feel it now. It's eager to awaken, just trembling on the edge now. But it can't cross over by itself.
Grant looked at her.
If you say so.
Nobby's not necessary at all. Items like the turtle aren't his pigeons, so to speak. As for Bushbaby Bob...
I go. I'm expendable.
Nah, that's no way to talk, Cobba.
Kane and your people are in grave danger, immediate danger. None of us is going to stay outside while our friends face death. Let's just quit debating and all go in.
Grant looked even grimmer than usual, but said no more. The entrance on the building's south end had been blocked by the collapse of a multi-story concrete structure across the narrow walkway. Whatever had fallen on the Maxwell had left a gaping rent in the side nearest the party. Grant and Bushbaby Bob led the way to it and stopped to peer inside. Grant carried a large plastic hand lantern that gave wider illumination than the Nighthawk microlights. He carried a copperhead in his other gauntleted hand. It wasn't a personal blaster the way a Sin Eater was, just a blaster from the armory. He wouldn't mind parting with it if it got contaminated with radioactive and intensely toxic heavy metal particles. He poked the blaster's muzzle brake into the building in advance of his head and shone in the light. Inside appeared to be an office, with a desk and a skeletal swivel chair lying on its side, half turned to rust on the floor. Its cushioned padding was desiccated and crumbled to dust. Bushbaby Bob pushed inside. He held a lantern of his own and a Franke Spass riot gun, each one-handed. Frowning unhappily, Grant followed. Stooping and high-stepping, the rest followed. Half the room and the hallway beyond stood open to the sky above. Grant and Bob moved on into the corridor. The second floor had fallen into the ground floor at an angle, blocking the hall to their right.
Whoa, what a mess.
This way. I feel it. Don't you?
She moved out in front and went that way. With misgivings, for she was their ticket out of here, but more importantly, she was the key to the whole mission, saving the Earth and just maybe Cain. They let her lead and followed warily, casting their eyes and their light beams from side to side. The corridor turned right. With unspeaking unity of mind, Grant and Bush Baby Bob shoved forward to make sure it was safe to go around, then let Rita resume the lead. The walls shook around them. Dust drifted down from the ceiling, which was here intact and even sported a weird, random, almost checkerboard of acoustic tiles and gaps. They heard the creaks and cracks of structural shifts, structural failures. Small, for now.
Damn!
It's as if there is something that does not want us to find the turtle. Something very powerful.
Grant turned his head to squint at her.
You're joking, right?
You feel it too?
Rita came to an opening on their right where the door had been. She gestured inside.
Here. It's here.
Bridget shouldered past Grant and the bull boy to stare into the room. It was mostly blocked by collapsed ceiling. And more, the second floor had partly come down here. Looking up, she could see stars and a crazy angled block of structure that seemed to be bouncing up and down as if still in motion from the earlier tremblers.
Must have sucked a handful of plutonium dust down right into here. Rad meters going bugfuck. Even in these suits, anybody in there longer than 5 minutes might as well just stay with the rest of the exhibits, because they're history.
The Earth commenced to spasm like a giant in convulsions. The straining beams that held the remnant of the second floor from obliterating the turtle's resting place began to crack with gunshot sounds.